from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore how we can rethink New Year's resolutions into opportunities for change.
It's important to avoid this idea of good and bad, of going on and off a diet. That's really not as important as saying, what can I do that becomes my norm?
We'll share some ways people can best prepare themselves for severe winter weather.
Emergency plans really should focus on what you're going to do if it's unsafe to leave the house or if it's unsafe to stay in the house.
Plus, we'll share some safety tips for those who plan to do any winter recreation on the ice. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. There's a lot of pressure in the new year to make some big changes, especially around nutrition, weight, and exercise. So how can you best approach your goals with a healthy and positive mindset? Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by UWM Professor Emeritus Susie Kundrat, a clinical professor in the Nutritional Sciences Program, to talk about healthy resolutions.
So the beginning of a new year can act as a type of reset or incentive for a lot of people, but for others, this time of year can be difficult and triggering. So what are some general tips you suggest as a starting point to assess what would be reasonable resolutions to take on?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point in that sometimes we feel all this pressure at the new year to make these big changes and these, really, especially around health, around nutrition and weight and exercise and those things. And I might challenge people to think of it as any kind of new opportunity at the beginning of a month. Yes, it's January, beginning of a new year, to really first do a bit of an assessment as opposed to just jumping into something. So, you know, taking it as, what am I doing now? What's my schedule like? How am I eating? How much activity am I getting? What are my opportunities? And think of it as an opportunity. So for example, instead of rushing in and saying, I'm going to go on this restrictive diet, which we really don't recommend, you might say, hey, I'm going to do an assessment of what's in my freezer. I'm going to pull these things out. Are there ways I can, for example, eat more vegetables? So maybe that's a good start as a positive to take advantage of what you already have and kind of work from there, as opposed to saying, I have to make these huge changes. We do know that if we set smaller goals and maybe look at doing smaller things, that's helpful. But we also have to remember that we have to support those opportunities. So it's wonderful to say, I'm going to eat more fruits and vegetables, which is probably the most important thing we can be doing from a nutrition standpoint. But the next step is to assess what you already have, make a grocery list, procure the items that you need, even make a list of your 5 favorite fruits and vegetables, go to the store and get those, and start there by actually having the food available, because it's very easy to think big, but then we have to go through these small steps to get there.
You mentioned restrictive diets, and that kind of made me think of how our culture, Western culture specifically, kind of celebrates the pain of going through something drastic, or like, oh, good on you, you're so determined, you know. But when does behavior shift from, quote, being really disciplined about something, you know, say about a new resolution or a diet, to actually being harmful to ourselves and our bodies?
Well, it can switch over very quickly, I think, to something that's harmful. And I don't think that people need to be in a situation where it's very painful for them. So that might be one thing, or where you're feeling that either other people are judging you or you're judging yourself harshly. If that's the case, then it's perhaps not really a healthy way to go about things. We know, for example, with nutrition, I mean, my background as a registered dietitian is certainly the science of nutrition, but there's so much more to it. So it's not just all about which foods are the highest nutrient foods to eat. That's important, but it's also about what do we like to eat? What are we comfortable eating? What tastes good to us? Or how do we feel good eating? Because we do know that if we're satisfied with what we eat, then for many of us, we don't eat as much. So if one of the goals is to lower your energy intake or your calories, for example, it's really important that you're eating things that you like. And so, you know, getting any kind of real restrictive eating pattern, whether it's cutting out certain food groups or only eating, you know, certain things, generally doesn't work very long, partly because it's too restrictive, partly because we may not be satisfied with what we're eating. And then we start feeling bad because we can't stay on something. I always tell my students and clients, if you're really restrictive and feeling bad about what you're eating and bad about your diet, then you can't blame yourself for not being able to kind of continue that, because it's just not reasonable. It's not realistic, and it's not healthy to feel bad about this.
With nutrition being a big thing right now, especially after the holidays, a lot of New Year practices are going from one end of the spectrum of overindulging, celebrating, doing all of the things, eating all the foods, drinking all the drinks, to the opposite, right? So what are some good small nutritional changes people can take on? You mentioned like one simple thing is make a goal to eat more fruits and veggies. What are some other simple things that we can work towards?
Right. So some other simple things are perhaps preparing a meal a day, if you can. I always say it's the 2-minute miracle. And what I mean by that is if you take 2 minutes to think about, oh, what might I have for dinner tonight? What could I prepare? Go look and see what you could pull out of the freezer. What can you prep? Just taking those couple minutes might be the difference between you making dinner and you ordering dinner to be delivered. Usually when we're eating at home, we have more control over what's in the food. And so by and large, we can eat a bit healthier because of that. And so I think that that's a big help. And that also usually cuts down the cost. So if you're, one of your goals is to lower the cost, then prepping more food and making more meals at home is helpful. I think another really critical piece of kind of shifting into this new year is securing support. And that is perhaps from someone in your home. It might be a friend that is also wanting to make changes. So for example, I often will send a picture of a recipe I made to my sister, or my wife and I will sit down and plan the meal for the evening. We do that in the morning. And so it's a lot easier to make it because we've already talked about it. We know what we're going to do. So taking a few of those steps to get other people involved in your wellness is really helpful. And I find that people really appreciate that. They love getting recipes or seeing pictures of this, or it's motivating to me when I get tips from a friend or family member or a colleague.
One thing that is kind of difficult, not just in our approach to eating, if we're making big changes, but our relationship with food, and especially as diet companies and other, quote, lifestyle products are really targeting people on the extreme scale right now. How do you suggest we move past this and evolve a lifestyle approach when it comes to food intake?
Well, I do think it's important to avoid this idea of good and bad, avoid this idea of going on and off a diet. That's really not as important as saying, what can I do that becomes my norm? You know, we read all kinds of things about habit forming, right? Atomic habits and forming habits, and whether it's 21 days or whether it's 1 to 2 months to form a habit, a big thing is being consistent. And so if we think more about consistency in what we're doing, again, setting ourselves up to make it easy. So getting to the store, if you can, having the food available. We talk often in terms of eating a piece of fresh fruit. Well, if you put a bowl of fruit out there and you see it when you walk by, you're probably going to grab a piece and eat it. So that's a simple step that you could do every day, perhaps, particularly if you're working at home, where you've got then opportunities. So I like to look at it as give yourself a hand, give yourself a chance by offering opportunities to yourself to practice wellness. And then those things are things that you can just carry on. You know, they're not the dieting culture per se. They're just more, this is what I do for myself. And I think particularly as women, we have to give ourselves a chance to be okay with taking that time and saying, it's okay if I spend a little energy and time on myself. And I need to do that so that I can prioritize wellness.
I like the idea of giving yourself opportunities versus restrictions. And as we kind of work towards these changes, road bumps are bound to happen, right? So how do we keep a positive or even neutral mindset, would you say, towards our goals?
Well, one important thing to think about is that if we really are honest about ourselves and the physiology of our bodies will be changed by what we do over weeks and months at a time. So you may have a day where you don't eat well, you didn't get much sleep, you didn't exercise. And sometimes people will look at that day and say, oh, I blew it, or I'm not doing everything rigidly every day, so I'm a failure, and put in these things that really aren't true when we think about how our body reacts. Our body doesn't really care if we had a day that we didn't eat well at all. Generally, that's not going to make a difference. So reminding ourselves that what our bodies respond to is what we do over time. And so being gentle with yourself, giving yourself a break in that way too is really important because it isn't so rigid. I think that's why sometimes I have challenges with plans or with diets where they say, oh, you know, you're really restrictive for 6 days. And then the seventh day you do whatever you want. That's fine, but you could do what you want for a lunch if you need to sometime. It doesn't have to be just one day. So giving yourself that flexibility. We know that some key, really important pieces of a healthy eating pattern, flexibility is one of those. And so let's be realistic about how our bodies respond. It's not going to be a problem if we have a day or a couple of days that just aren't as healthy per se. We're still going to be fine.
Do you think that New Year's resolutions can do more harm than good? Is there a better way to approach our health and wellness?
I think that New Year's resolutions, if they're too restrictive, can do more harm than good, or if they're not realistic. And so, for example, I don't really recommend people base resolutions solely on weight, for example, because as we know, people, we all respond differently to how we eat and how we move our bodies. We can't really say how much weight someone's going to lose specifically by doing certain things. We can say that we might have averages and those kinds of things. But if we base it solely on something like weight, we may be more apt to do things that are too restrictive to get that weight down. And the weight isn't as important as the wellness in your body. We do know that. We know that someone can be very fit and healthy at many different weights. And so I think that maybe taking weight out of the picture, if you can, and just say, what I'm going to focus on is the daily things that I can do from a nutrition, a wellness, a support standpoint. And if my body's meant to lose weight, it will come. So I would say, even if weight's part of your goals, just have it be a small part of the goal, not the main thing, because I think that can be very negative and can be harmful. I do think it's helpful for us to kind of reevaluate and kind of set up for the new year. I think that's fine. I think it's positive, but we need to remember that for some people, January 1 is not the most ideal time to make these changes, particularly those of us who live in the North, right? We may find, I have a lot of clients who really can make better changes in the spring because they can get outside more, they can move more, the weather's better, it's warmer. The winter can be kind of a tough time in Wisconsin. So think about that too. They say, well, I might be able to make, maybe I'll start with some nutrition changes and some activity, but then once the weather gets better, boy, I can be out more doing things. So being realistic about that, depending upon where we live as well, is important.
Well, Susie, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your insights. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
I have too. Thank you so much.
Susie Kundrat is a clinical professor emeritus in the nutritional sciences program at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski back in 2022. Clear and safe roads are obviously critical during winter weather, but there is an environmental impact of all of the salt that gets scattered on our roadways and sidewalks in the winter, especially on our local waterways. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz spoke with Cheryl Nen of Milwaukee Riverkeeper about that impact and what we can all do to minimize it.
Most of our storm drains outside of the real core of downtown Milwaukee and the southern part of Shorewood, a lot of the runoff from the roads goes directly to the river system. In the downtown Milwaukee area, that's the combined sewer area, quite a lot of that runoff in some of the downtown streets does run to the sewage treatment plant. You know, the sewage treatment plant was designed, obviously, to treat human waste, but it can remove some extent of other pollutants, solids, things like that, some bacteria. But, you know, there's a lot of the salt is dissolved, and so that would go through the treatment plant and then be essentially discharged back to the lake.
So for rivers, lakes, well, let's just talk rivers because here we are.
Yeah.
What becomes of runoff that it contains chloride that ends out in the river?
Yeah, so a lot of the runoff goes into the river with the road salt, and a lot of that stays in the river system, and quite a lot of it will settle out into the bottom of the river. And unfortunately, we know that that salt is now persisting. Riverkeeper has been monitoring for chloride since 2010. We are starting to see some concerning trends. One is we are, you know, finding a lot of problems now in summer months. What that means, it's multiple things potentially, but I think in some cases, the salt that's getting into the rivers and many lakes is persisting there and causing pollution. And in the summer months, this year would be a good example, you know, we didn't have as much rainfall. So a lot of the rivers got very, very low this summer. And so that salt that's sitting on the bottom of the river becomes more concentrated. The concentrations of chloride increase. And we have seen a few pretty high spikes in summer months, which is something that we hadn't historically really seen. And I think, you know, if you look over long-term trends, the salt levels are generally increasing in a lot of the urban waterways in particular. Some of our more rural waterways, we've been doing a lot of monitoring up there too, and we do have a couple exceedances in what I would consider more rural or suburban streams, but most of them are, you know, really focused around the urban core where we have a lot of roads. We have a lot of runoff from highways as well, from I-94, from I-43, from I-41 and 45. You know, all of those big interstates that are so snow-free and instantly, you know, it seems like they do a great job, you know, de-icing quickly so that we all can get where we need to go. But all of that salt is running off, and a lot of it is running off into the water.
What does it mean to fish, to aquatic life, to human life?
Right. Well, it is very toxic for fish and aquatic life. And when we do monitoring, we look at two different levels of chloride, one we call chronic and one we call acute. But basically, an acute exceedance is one that where the chloride levels are so high that we think it could be, you know, instantly toxic to fish and aquatic life. You know, they could potentially die. We also look at lower levels of salt that we is considered more of a chronic toxicity, which is, you know, over like a 4-day period, for example, of, you know, slightly lower but still elevated levels. With those types of scenarios, it still could be very harmful to fish and aquatic life, could cause a lot of stress to organisms, affect their, you know, their functioning, their ability to reproduce and survive. So there's huge aquatic impacts from the road salt. From our perspective, you know, we're also in a lot of the salt that's draining our homes and our businesses and our roads is also, you know, going into Lake Michigan eventually from a lot of these tributary rivers like the Milwaukee and the Menominee and the Kinnickinnick. And, you know, that's our drinking water supply. And there are a lot of folks that do a lot more research on the lake and have been seeing some noticeable increases in salt levels in the lake as well. And so, you know, I think reducing salt, really minimizing the amount that we're using as residents can really help protect our water supply as well. Salt also is really harmful to, you know, a lot of plantings. A lot of different plants can be affected through salt burn, right, through when we're using a lot of salt this time of year. And it can harm pets, so paws of dogs, other animals, that they can become, their paws can become really dried out and cracked due to the salt. And I think also there's a real damage to property. So I think people can probably notice that on their own property, can damage like that bottom of your garage door that starts rotting out, right? Which I might be have at my house. And I really don't use salt, but at all, if I can get away with it. But, you know, it can damage a lot of metal. It damages a lot of infrastructure that are, you know, city, bridges. County and state bridges. especially metal bridges, but also can, you know, really corrode other building materials like concrete and other surfaces out there.
So I think there's been a trend in recent years of some municipalities moving away from salt, road
yes.
salt. Where does that stand, or has that had mixed reviews in terms of, as you said, we're used to having our roads cleared,
yeah,
right?
cleared and ready.
We want to move.
Yeah, it's true. I'm not really sure if there's more recent data, but I know at one point when we really looked into this, I think Milwaukee County was using kind of 8 times the salt per lane mile than many other counties. So, I mean, there is one element of we have a lot more roads, and so that might be why a lot of our urban rivers are struggling more with the salt pollution. But we also know we're just applying a lot more than other counties per mile. And part of that is the expectation that our roads and surfaces need to be instantly cleared. I know some years back there was some change in policy where I know the city of Milwaukee kind of tried to just really minimize salting on side streets and really just focus on the main arterial roads. And there was a lot of pushback from people about that. But, you know, I know, like, living where I live, I'm within, you know, several blocks in all directions of a main arterial. So I could drive a little bit slower on my side street until I got to the main street, like one block down or 2 blocks down. But there, you know, that really requires a lot of education and outreach, because people really, really do expect, you know, all of our roads to be instantly, you know, plowed or plowed within a couple hours of a big storm. And so part of that's, you know, education as far as expectations of all of us, and that needs to change. There are some cities really reducing their salt. I know some cities are really focusing on doing kind of intersections and streets that have slope, but really trying to minimize application in other places. So, you know, I think a lot of cities have over the last couple of years switched to kind of wet applications of salt. And basically brine. And a lot of people have noticed that, because you'll see like those lines on the road as opposed to the granular salt. So a lot of times that happens before a storm, and it really is kind of like greasing your frying pan. It's trying to stop the snow and ice from adhering to the road. Also, so it's a lot easier for the trucks to blade up. And so by using the brine systems, it can actually dramatically reduce the overall salt that a city uses, because they need much less to make the brine. And by going out and kind of pre-applying it, it can make it much easier for the trucks to take it off, so they don't need to use as much granular product, you know, for like kind of problem areas. Right. A lot of cities have dramatically reduced their salt. I think Cudahy is, you know, reduced like really significant amount. Mm-hmm. And that also is like a huge cost saving for a municipality, because some of these municipalities, they spend, you know, an incredible amount of money on road salt every year. And you have to kind of buy it whether you use it or not. The way that a lot of the contracts are put out there. So, you know, they can save a lot of money by just using, you know, trying to use the right product at the right time and the right quantity. I think one of the things that's a little bit tricky is, you know, like road salt, like sodium chloride, which a lot of us use, rock salt, a lot of those products don't really work when it's colder than 15 degrees. And so that's just something for people to know. Like, I think you see sometimes when it gets really cold, people apply more salt, thinking like it's going to do something. But applying more salt, more of the wrong product, is not going to help, you know, melt your ice or you know, minimize ice creation. And so, you know, I think a lot of cities are switching to alternative types of products. There's like calcium chlorides, magnesium chlorides, different products that work in colder temperatures, but they're all still chloride-based. And so from a water quality perspective, there's still a concern there. And then we're recently finding out that things like magnesium, they still have the same toxic water quality impact. I think a lot of this is going to come down to, you know, just changing our expectations of how much of this product, you know, needs to be applied. If you go up north, for example, I think a lot of us go to different parts of the state or different parts of the country. You know, there are places that they're not, they don't use salt at all. They're just using sand for traction. People are driving on snow compacted roads. You have to drive a lot slower. And maybe that's not practical for everywhere, but I think there certainly are, like, you know, kind of small steps that we can take to reduce the salt usage, even in cities like Milwaukee and then and kind of the urban suburban core around us. And, you know, I think we all need to do better. I think, you know, using only the salt that you absolutely need to, we often tell people that you can use like a coffee cup of salt, and that should be good enough for a driveway if you have like a typical urban, like 20-foot long, you know, Milwaukee driveway. Or about 10, you can also use about one coffee cup of salt for about 10 sidewalk squares. And that's really enough product. You should be able to see a lot of space in between them. You know, if you're seeing after a storm, like lots of salt remaining and big streaks of salt, which we see sometimes on parking lots around town, then you've put way too much product out. we do want everybody to be safe. We don't want to create, you know, icy, unsafe conditions. And so if you have problem drainage areas, porches or something where you might have some persistent gutter issues, you probably need to fix the gutter issue, right? And that's stuff we always forget about until now. But in the summer, you know, really think about what's happening with the drainage of the house. Do you have gutters you need to fix? Can you direct water away from paved surfaces? Those are all just good practices. And so I think a lot of this too could just be common sense, but I think everybody has a role to play in minimizing the salt, and that will help protect the river and the lake and our drinking water supply. And so I think it would be really wonderful if everybody could do something and just really be a little bit more mindful. And it also will save you quite a lot of money.
Cheryl Nen is the Milwaukee Riverkeeper's riverkeeper. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz last year. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 10 minutes, we'll share some ways to stay safe around ice this winter. But first, we'll tell you what you need to keep in your car and house to be prepared for severe winter weather. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Temperatures in Milwaukee aren't expected to break freezing this week. And while no big snow is expected, it's always good to be prepared for unexpected winter weather. Lake Effect's Exquit Nunez speaks with Andrew Beckett from Ready, Wisconsin, and Jen Warren from the Red Cross to learn how people can prepare themselves for future winter storms.
Jen, I want to start off by asking, what are some terms people should become familiar with in preparation for a winter storm? So, for instance, what's the difference between a winter storm warning versus a winter storm watch?
I think it's important to know the difference between both of those so that you know how long that you have to prepare. So a winter storm warning means that life-threatening or severe winter weather conditions have begun or will begin within 24 hours. A winter storm watch means winter storm conditions are possible within the next 36 to 48 hours.
And so, Andrew, I want to ask, before a winter storm arrives, what are some supplies people should have on hand to take care of themselves and anyone else at home?
Well, you really want to look at having kits in both your home and your vehicle if you could potentially be on the road really at any time during the winter. And we'll start with kits at home. You know, kits at home really should include things like having a supply of at least, 72 hours of non-perishable food, preferably something that doesn't require having to be cooked, so that if you were to lose power or natural gas service, you're able to make sure that everybody in your home remains fed. You also want to make sure that you have a supply of water for everyone who's living in your home. The standard is really about a gallon of water per person in your home per day for both hygiene and cooking and eating purposes. In addition to that, items such as flashlights, extra batteries, having a battery operated or at least battery backup NOAA weather radio so that you can get critical alerts and updates, making sure that you know where things like extra supplies of medication might be located, whether they're in a kit itself or if you keep them somewhere else in the home. And really, those are kind of some of the essential supplies. But, it also comes with having a plan for what you're going to do. In the event that the worst does happen and you lose power and you're not expected to get it back for a significant amount of time, or your furnace goes out in your home, what steps you're going to take in order to make sure that everybody stays safe. In vehicles, kits should include some of those things like some snacks, blankets, jumper cables, make sure you have a good snow scraper in your vehicle, a cell phone charger, kitty litter in case you get stuck somewhere for a little bit of extra traction. If you have room in the trunk, a snow shovel is a good thing to keep on you. Extra hats and gloves, and then just also making sure that you know what to do if you were to get stuck and who to call for help so that you can hopefully get out of there as quickly as possible or have somebody take you to safety.
And Andrew, you mentioned this earlier too. I also noticed Ready Wisconsin recommends people and families make an emergency plan ahead of the winter storm. What does an emergency plan look like?
Well, you know, emergency plans really should focus on what you're going to do if it's unsafe to leave the house or if it's unsafe to stay in the house. And really, we'll look at it from those two ways. You know, if you are unable to leave the house, you know, you need to make sure that you have that plan, including things like having that emergency kit stocked up, making sure that that's done in advance, making sure that you have those essential contact numbers on hand, whether it's going to be, you know, emergency furnace repair, calling a contact number for the power company in case you do lose service and you need to contact them in order to make sure that, you know, they're aware that you are out and you're on their list for places to get repaired. But also, you know, in case it is unsafe to stay home, identifying where you're going to go, whether that's going to be potentially shelters that are available in your area, other members of your family, basically knowing how you're safely going to be able to stay somewhere else if it's not safe to stay at home.
Okay, so let's say the winter storms arrived and someone's been outside for too long. Jen, I want to ask you, what are some of the telltale signs of hypothermia and frostbite, and is this preventable?
Sure. So shivering is one of the first signs of hypothermia. Other signs can include confusion, drowsiness, and slurred speech. For frostbite, your nose, ears, cheeks, chin, fingers, and toes are often the first affected. People might experience pain, numbness, and a change of skin color. In terms of what people can do for hypothermia, seek emergency medical care right away. Move to a warm place and remove any wet clothing and warm the body slowly. For frostbite, move to a warm place, warm the affected area gently by soaking it in warm water, not hot water, until the skin appears normal and then feels warm, and then seek emergency medical care.
And so, Andrew, you mentioned this earlier too, you know, what is a plan if you're at home and your power goes out? What should someone do in that situation?
Well, really the first thing that you should do if you lose power at home is to make sure that you've contacted your utility provider to let them know, because they're the ones who are going to be able to address that outage. They're the ones who are going to give you an update on what possible restoration times are and if there's any specific concerns you need to be worried about. Typically speaking, with power outages, there's usually something that's happened to a main line somewhere, but you also want to be aware of any damage that might have occurred on your property, usually with the connection between your house and where the service comes into it. Some of these winter storms, we see heavy snow and ice on trees. They can drop limbs on lines. If they cause any damage to the infrastructure that actually connects the power to your house, you might have to additionally look at getting something like an electrician out in order to fix that last bit of service to make sure that the connection to the house is restored. If you have the ability to have a generator installed, you know, that is something that many people can look at, especially if they might be in more rural areas or areas where they feel like, you know, they lose power a lot and they want to have a solution there. It's very important with generators, though, that they're being operated and installed properly. You know, especially standalone generators need to be at least 20 feet away from your home, make sure they're vented properly, so that there's not that risk of carbon monoxide poisoning from having them operating. They should never be run inside an enclosed space, even inside like your garage, because there is a potential danger with those that can, you know, very quickly become deadly if they're not used properly. So really, if you do decide to use a generator, make sure that it's being installed by a professional who knows what they're doing and that it's being operated properly and tested regularly so that when you need it, you know that it's going to operate properly.
Right. And in situations like these, people might need shelter to turn to. Where might people find shelter if they need it? Or what are some resources people can turn to?
Shelter information is going to vary widely based on where you live. Some municipalities may set up warming centers. They may work with organizations like the Red Cross or other volunteer organizations to set up shelter operations overnight if conditions really warrant it, and they see a demand for having that resource available. So really the best resource that an individual might need to look at is local government websites, social media accounts, because typically speaking, if they open warming centers or overnight shelters, they're going to post that information in a public place where people can hopefully see it. And then they're going to also send that information out to local media in order to help publicize it. So really, one of the first places that people should be looking is to their local government to see what information is being shared out there. A number of counties do also utilize 211 during periods of severe weather in order to help collect information, but also to share information with residents. So if you do have 211 available in your area, which should be in most counties in the state, you can contact there and they should be able to at least point you in the right direction for additional resources.
Well, Jen and Andrew, thank you both so much for speaking with me today and sharing this helpful advice.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Beckett is a public information officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management and leads the state's Ready Wisconsin campaign. Jen Warren is the regional communications director for the American Red Cross Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez last year. Whether we like it or not, ice is an essential part of Wisconsin winters. From fishing to skating, ice can be a great place to have fun in the freezing cold. But it can also be a risky place. Injuries and accidents can happen on the ice, and understanding how to mitigate these risks is a necessary part of the experience. Jason Roberts is a recreation warden for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He joins me with his tips on how to be prepared for the worst when enjoying the best things that ice has to offer.
You know, here in Wisconsin and anywhere in the upper Midwest here, we deal with ice, and there's a lot of fun things you can do out on the ice, and can be a whole lot of fun. The challenge always comes into play is whether or not the ice is safe. And to answer your question, is ice ever safe? Inherently, you're standing on water. So no, it's not always safe, and it can't always be safe, but there are certain conditions and there are times in which people can safely recreate. There's always a risk associated with going out onto frozen water. But for the most part, if you use good common sense and you take some precautionary measures, bring along appropriate safety tools, you can be safe out there and have a great time.
Let's look into some of this kind of common sense knowledge. When we're thinking about ice, of course, we're talking about a lot of different types of bodies of water. There's lakes in Wisconsin, there's rivers, there's ponds. Are there any types of water that you really shouldn't walk on?
Sure, yeah. Most people, when they're out recreating, tend to go on to our inland bodies of water, our lakes. And even though lakes are a solid block of water, there often are inlets and outlets where water moves in and moves out of these lake bodies. Those areas in particular are places you should stay away from. So my recommendation is when it comes to rivers and it comes to inlets and outlets of inland water bodies, inland lakes, those are areas you should stay away from. Whenever you have water moving underneath ice, it compromises the ice itself and you can have problems. Wherever water levels can change, you get that air gap between the water level and the actual ice, you get buckling, you get cracks in the ice, and that's where things get a little sketchy as far as walking on top of it.
Well, that gets to another question that I have. I grew up on Geneva Lake down in Lake Geneva, and one of the big concerns that we always had was heating and cooling. You know, we'd have like a couple weeks where it got above freezing and then it would go back below and back above. How does that impact the integrity of the ice?
Sure. In the southern part of the state, we get a lot of these warm 40-degree days where on occasion you'll get a bit of rain. There's a couple of common things that you can see and notice about the ice that would give you the sense that maybe you should stay away from it. Seeing water on top of the ice, seeing a different color of ice, like what we call black ice, a darker ice. That's ice that indicates it's getting to the point where the water's level is getting closer to the surface you can see. So as the ice gets darker, the snow starts to disappear, and you see standing water, those are all indications that things can be a little dicey out there. Whenever you have that heating and cooling with the ice, you compromise the safety of that ice because you get an effect. You get a what they call a honeycombing effect with the thawing and refreezing. Whereas you may see or drill down or use a spud bar and see, hey, there's 8 inches of ice. That's plenty to walk on. But once that ice has been compromised with that thawing and refreezing, you get that honeycomb effect, which it may appear to be 8 inches, but in reality, it doesn't have the structural integrity to hold people, and especially not recreational vehicles or motor vehicles themselves.
We had a situation down in Lake Geneva that I think became a bit infamous because a number of cars fell into the ice during one of these periods where there was a lot of heating and cooling.
Yeah, that was a comedy of errors in all different aspects out there. If you were down there, and I was down there when that occurred, and the incident you're referring to is when basically they utilized the lake itself, the frozen lake, as a parking lot for their Winterfest. And in that scenario, you had cars parked just like a parking lot right off of the landing, the boat landing onto the ice. And whenever you have that much weight in a small area and you have it adjacent to a roadway and a boat ramp where there's runoff, you get salt that washes into the lake from the roadways, you get compromised ice, and you get what you saw, which was dozens of vehicles getting submerged in the water.
When we're talking about ice safety, we're also talking about inherently the dangers that ice presents. What are the biggest dangers that can happen when you're on the ice?
The obvious one is certainly falling through, but even beyond that, just slipping and falling is a big issue. One of the top things that wardens get injured, you know, wardens, people going out checking fishing licenses, simply slipping on ice. For that reason, we've implemented a policy where we utilize the creeper system, which is basically a spike that you put on your shoe. You can buy them. Some people used to make them in the old days, but nowadays everyone just straps them on their feet. It's a way of keeping you upright in those slippery conditions. The bigger concern, of course, is what I mentioned, alluded to earlier, which is falling through the ice. And I think if that scenario develops, having the proper gear along with you or having people with you to both help you get out or also if you're alone to self-rescue yourself is really key to staying safe out there. And there are numerous products out there that are available to our recreating public. And it's just a question of whether you want to invest in those life-saving measures. And to me, it's a no-brainer. Many of the ice fishing suits that they make nowadays, the snowmobiling suits that they make nowadays, all have built-in flotation systems. They have some sort of padding that will help keep the person afloat, because that really is key. If you do fall in the water, just be aware that there is going to be that cold shock response. That's just normal. You're going to lose your breath a bit. But if you calm down and give yourself 30 seconds, for the most part, you should be able to get yourself out if, in fact, you're wearing a jacket that provides some flotation. And also, if you have some rescue pegs or rescue sticks, which are basically just these little pegs that you wear around your neck or keep in your pocket, if you're able to get to them if you fall in the water, you can actually utilize them to pull yourself up onto the ice. Because without them, it's very challenging. It's very difficult. We've ran scenarios where we've gone in with some wetsuits and boy, it's really difficult to get out if you don't have some means of holding on to the ice, which is going to be wet and cold. And these spikes actually allow you to slide up kind of like a sea otter getting on top of the ice.
As we're thinking about the different supplies and the different things that we need to prepare for being on the ice, you mentioned a suit that can be submerged in water and still keep you warm, spikes to help you get out of the ice. What are some other supplies that you should always be carrying with you?
Sure. I'm a big advocate if you're going to be out there on a lake, especially ice fishermen, if you're going to be out there on the lake, to bring a boat seat cushion, which actually is a U.S. Coast Guard approved flotation system. It's a what they call a Type 4. Everyone thinks of it as the square boat cushion that you sit on just to be more comfortable. And I am a big advocate of that. To have that out there, it's much more comfortable to sit in the seat on the bucket with this cushion, but it also provides an important rescue mechanism if, in fact, you do go in. Keeping yourself from drowning is really the key. And that sounds silly to say, don't drown if you fall through the water. But really, when you fall in the water, you're so set on getting out, when in reality, you have time. You got to focus on your swimming. You got to focus on staying above the water level. And that's really key. And if you have that boat seat cushion, you can stay above water. And hopefully you can either have people there available to you to help you get out or able to get to your phone and make a call. Another big piece of equipment that you can carry that people don't often think of is a rescue bag. A simple rescue rope that you can throw to somebody is really key to get yourself out or to get some a family member or a fellow fisherman that's out in the ice that happens to fall through. The key is not to become a victim yourself and not rushing to be the hero by jumping in the water to rescue somebody, but rather providing something for them to get themselves out, which is a rope, something they can reach for.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing these tips.
Thank you for having me.
Jason Roberts is a recreation warden for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We spoke back in 2021. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll share how to brew the perfect cup of tea. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Before we wrap up today's show, we've got a little tutorial to share with those looking to warm up this winter with a nice cup of tea. Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Rishi Tea, and he joins WUWM's Mayan Silver to explain how to brew the perfect cup of tea.
It depends on the type of tea. Every tea has a different amount of tea that you would add to the teapot, and the water temperature is also very important. But as a basic rule of thumb, for green teas or black teas, anything in between, use 2 teaspoons per cup. Boil the water just off a boil, add the water to the tea, let it steep for 3 minutes, and strain it in its entirety and enjoy it. It might be a little weak, it might be a little strong the first time. You can adjust the amount of tea and you can adjust the amount of time, but don't use water that's too hot or you'll extract too much tannin and the tea may become bitter.
You want to put the water in just as it starts boiling or just before it starts boiling?
Good question. You want to bring the water to a boil and then let it cool down a little bit. So maybe boil the water and let it cool for 3-4 minutes and pour it over the tea.
Nice. Kind of like what people do with a French press with coffee a little bit, sort of.
Yeah, and French presses are awesome for herbal teas, scented teas, flavored teas. French presses are really utilitarian, easy to use kitchenwares for brewing tea.
And besides the French press, are there any other contraptions people should use? How do they know how long the tea should steep? Does it say on the box?
It does. For green teas and white teas, it's better to use porcelain or glass. And for more dark teas or fermented teas, it's nice to use earthenware teapots.
I see. Okay. And what about adding anything into it? Lemon, some people like milk. Is that, what's your take on that? Flavoring, sugar?
Yeah, I drink my teas neat. I never add any milk. I never add any sugar. Really fine teas have unique aromatic profiles, different levels of bittersweetness and sweetness. And the aftertaste is something to behold. When you add lemon or milk or sugar to a fine tea, You're really missing the point. Tea is something that tastes just lovely on its own without any additives.
And for people who may not be able to take the caffeine in the tea, you know, the people that for health reasons stick with the herbal tea, are there favorites? You mentioned ginger. Is there something else that you would recommend for different properties?
Oh yeah, there's so many good teas with so many good herbs without caffeine. Rooibos is one. And it's similar to tea in that it has this reddish infusion, and it has a very special, almost like a honey and fruity characteristic. You can steep it like a black tea. Rooibos is very nice. I think ginger, turmeric ginger, is something that's really good for our bodies and our immune systems. Those are very, very good teas for this season.
So you're encouraging people to sort of develop their tea taste buds.
Yes, yes. And there's so many different varieties of tea that there's something out there for everybody. And certainly we think about eating seasonally. We can also think about drinking tea seasonally. During these cold winters, it's good to drink teas that will warm up your constitution, warm up your body, and increase your metabolism. So darker teas, more fermented teas, like a ruby oolong or a Taiguanyin oolong or a pu'er tea, those are really good to warm up your body and during this winter time. Ginger is amazing. If you wanna add sugar or lemon to anything, try a ginger tea or a ginger herbal tea or a turmeric ginger tea. Those are all amazing during this time of year.
Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Reishi Tea and Botanicals based in Milwaukee. He spoke to WUWM's Mayan Silver. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you'd like to listen to some of our favorite interviews from 2024, you can find those at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.